This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. At the end of last year, Dr. John Connaughton, if I remember correctly, didn't see a rosy year ahead in 2012 economically. He turned out to be right about that. It is only now, in the last part of the year, that things seem to be getting a little better. Unemployment nationally has declined ever so slightly. And here in Charlotte, the housing market is showing signs of life. Home sales and prices seem to be on the incline. But what about other sectors? What kind of year has 2012 turned out to be, and what might 2013 have in store? We've been meeting quarterly with Dr. Connaughton since the beginning of the recession for a little financial checkups. He's the Babson Capital Professor of Financial Economics at UNC Charlotte and the director of the Babson Capital Economic Forecast, the official forecast for the state, and he is back with us again this hour. Welcome back.
Good morning, Mike.
Good morning. We must like you a lot in person because you haven't had much good news for us in recent years, and yet we keep inviting you back. How would you characterize North Carolina's economy in 2012?
Well, I think you already did. It was pretty bad, unfortunately. In fact, I was not optimistic this time last year about 2012, and it turned out to be actually not as good as I thought it was going to be. We only added about 6,000 jobs, 35,000 jobs this year. When it's all done, that's about how many we'll add, and that's just simply not acceptable. That is just we should be adding 100,000 jobs a year. And in fact, over the last 3.5 years since the job recovery began, we have only gotten back about 33% of the jobs that we lost during the Great Recession. Compare that nationally. Nationally, we've gotten back almost 55% of the jobs we lost. And you remember in the campaign, unless I miss something, from both Obama's standpoint and Romney's standpoint, jobs and their plan for job creation was the number one issue in the campaign. And, you know, nationally, we had gotten back 55%. Here in North Carolina, we've only gotten back about 33% of the jobs we lost. I don't know. The state is really just not performed well coming out of this recession for a variety of reasons. I'm not sure you can pinpoint any one reason.
And yet yesterday on a local newscast, I heard that North Carolina is the best state in the nation for business.
Well, it depends on which one you talk about. There's others that haven't fought. But it always turns up in the top 8 or 10 states anyway. But we are the fifth worst state in terms of the unemployment rate right now. So only states like California and Nevada are ahead of us in terms of the unemployment rate. And we've been in that list of top five states or worst five states for the rate of unemployment for the last year and a half, and we just haven't budged out of it. And kind of in a sort of a comparison, South Carolina used to be in that list at the beginning of the recovery. They've moved out of it completely. They're not even within earshot of that list. And, you know, they're doing much, much better. In fact, they've created almost as many jobs last year as we did. And, of course, the state's less than half the size. So, you know, we have really fallen down in terms of economic development and just basically employment growth compared to where we used to be for the last several decades.
Is that due to reluctance on the part of businesses either to expand or add people or move here, or is it a part and parcel of the problem that we have with state government?
Those are all macro factors that you mentioned in terms of, you know, they're there everywhere in terms of the uncertainty because of what's going on in Washington and stuff like that. That's every state has to deal with that. But ours is a more micro problem, and I think it's partly because what was really hit hard in this past recession, North Carolina had a lot of. We had a very large manufacturing sector, got hammered. We had a very large construction sector because we were growing, so we had a lot of construction activity. We know that got hammered. In addition to that, we had a very large financial sector, and we all know what happened in that. So
we have a deeper hole to dig ourselves out of?
We have a deeper hole, but also it hurt our economy a little bit worse, the recession, than the average economy. Mm-hmm. So we got hammered for different reasons, but we got hammered like Nevada got hammered, like California got hammered.
How big a role did the uncertainty over the election and the outcome of the election up until election day led to this problem or exacerbated the problem? And how much is a fundamental problem with the economy or with the workings of it?
Every state has to deal with the uncertainty created by the election and the fact that we really, from a federal government standpoint, didn't do very much for the past 6 months. And, of course, we're all facing the fiscal cliff as we go forward. So that everybody has to deal with. I suspect in this state that we have simply lost our eye, if you will. We've lost the target of economic development in the state compared to some of the states around us, and they've stepped up their level of competition with us, and we've kind of just kind of dropped the ball, if
why?
You will.
Why? How?
I really don't. I really can't speak to that in terms of why that's the case. But when you listen to what's going on in South Carolina, you know, they had the Boeing announcement. I mean, the announcements keep going and going and going in terms of the big name firms are coming in with thousands of jobs.
Well, is that because their taxes are lower, their gasoline prices are lower, they have better roads than we have, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera?
Yes. Yeah, we have higher both personal income tax rates, higher corporate tax rates, and we also have higher sales tax rates. Higher property tax and higher gas tax. And at some point in time, that all starts to take a toll. And, yeah, that's part of the problem. But I think also we've become less proactive in terms of our effort and our focus in terms of trying to create economic development in the state.
In your latest forecast, the one you released earlier this week, you say that for 2012, North Carolina's real GSP is expected to increase by 0.6% over the 2011 level. How does that compare with what you may have predicted about 2012 last year, and how does that number compare to what it would have been in the most recent years preceding the recession?
Okay, first of all, let's give this a benchmark. We should be growing at 3 to 3.5% at a minimum. That's where you should be at this point in a recovery. Where you know, the recovery started in 2009. That was a half a year recovery, modest, but in earnest it started in 2010. 11, 12, this is the third solid year of recovery. We should be growing at or above our long-term growth rate, which is somewhere in the low 3 to 3.5% range. We're not even close to that. We were expecting last year that we'd probably be about 1.5% growth this year. We realized that it would not be a stellar year, but we didn't realize how bad it would be.
And when you say growth, what is that? Is that
it's the output of goods and services that are produced within the borders of the state. And the number, the 0.6% or the 3.5% that I'm talking about, that's adjusted for inflation. So it's real terms, how much more goods and services that we produced in this state.
So would more jobs lead that or follow that?
That more jobs follow that. And that's the fundamental problem that we're facing both within the state and facing nationally, and really is a bigger issue in terms of this fiscal cliff and the deficit than we're led to believe by the politicians.
So when the politicians campaigned all last year on jobs, both here in the state and nationally, and some people will say they had a plan. Other people will say, I didn't see any plan. I just heard them talk about jobs. How do you do that? How do you create jobs if they follow a recovery and nobody seems to want to recover?
Here's a very simple way to understand this. If what we have observed over the past several decades is that labor productivity, that's the output per worker, has been growing at about 1.5 to 2% a year. So if the economy grows between 1.5 and 2% in real terms, firms do not have to hire any additional workers in order to produce an additional 1.5 to 2%. Labor productivity should take care of that. So if we're going to start to hire more folks, create more jobs, we've got to create an economy that grows faster than 2%. Yet when you look at the growth nationally and you look at the growth in North Carolina over the past 3 years of this recovery, you can't find a year where we've grown significantly above 2%. And most of the time we've been at or below 2%. So that's where this problem is. If you can start to grow at 3.5% and labor productivity is at 1.5%, you've got to increase your labor force by 2% to get to that 3.5%. And 2% of the labor force is about 2.5 million jobs.
How about we just stop working so darn hard?
Well, it doesn't work that way,
okay.
Mike. Okay. But my point is that you're right about your analysis of what was being talked about in the election, because they talked about jobs because that's how people understand it. But the reality is that you're not going to create a single job unless you can get that economy growing at a faster pace than 2%, which is all we've been able to achieve.
And since the government doesn't really, except through tax policy perhaps, doesn't really control whether or not a company is going to build another factory or hire 10 more people, how do you get business to do that?
Well, I think that what we've been experiencing in the past 3 years of this recovery has been on a couple of different fronts. I think there's an overriding problem that we walked out of this recession with, and that is, and everybody's heard this term, new normal. Mm-hmm. We got beat up pretty hard. We got blindsided in some respects in terms of what put us into that hole and how bad that hole was. And as a result of that, we become a little gun shy. And this new normal basically is we are less of risk takers. We are very risk averse. We are very cautious. We're not willing to, I mean, look at what consumers have done. They've deleveraged themselves by about 25 to 30% in terms of their outstanding credit over the past 5 years. So consequently, we've created a very, very meek, if you will, behavior on the part of consumers, businesses, banks, and even government sector.
Talking to Dr. John Connaughton, the director of the Babson Capital Economic Forecast, about the state's misfortunes this year and what may the year ahead may hold this morning on WFAE's Charlotte Talks. This new normal phrase, is that really the reality? I've been thinking a lot about this because, you know, we heard it a lot, particularly when the bottom fell out. Well, this is the new normal. We're never going back to that. Get used to being poor. Get used to not being able to buy every trinket that comes along. Is that a way to make us calm down and be more complacent about this, or is it a reality?
I don't know about the psychology, but what I take away from this is that, and this is, I think this is the important crux here, that people are very risk averse right now. Mm-hmm. And if everybody were to take their money, you know, we all know there's a risk return trade-off. If everybody puts their money in CDs and they're getting less than 1% return, that's very risk averse. Zero risk involved in that, but you get a very, very modest return. Whereas if they were to lend it to somebody who might have a harebrained idea about how they could make a lot of money and they would get a 4 or 5% return, mm-hmm. but they're not interested in that. Banks aren't interested in that. Individuals aren't interested in that. Individuals aren't interested in going into debt right now because they don't know they have a job or whether their income will be able to afford to make the payments,
or what taxes will be.
Or
whether you
can
deduct your home mortgage.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. All these things are basically causing people to be very, very timid. And so if you have a very risk-averse actors in your economy, mm-hmm. businesses, government, consumers, banks, we will have a very low rate of growth.
Well, you've laid out some bad news, the 0.6% growth over 2012. But the good news is that you say 10 of the state's 15 economic sectors are forecast to experience output increases for this past year, with the strongest expected growth coming from business and professional services, mining, hospitality and leisure, information and construction. So what's driving those increases?
Well, again, business and professional services, educational health, leisure, hospitality services, they have all been doing very, very well during this recovery. They have been the leading sectors in terms of job creation. Kind of when you drill down into some of those and look what's behind just the overall title. For example, if we look at education and health services, they actually didn't decline during the recession. That's partly because of the baby boomers aging and what's going on with health, and it's also partly because people lose their jobs, they tend to go get more education. So those sectors were almost recession-proof and have been growing fairly modestly even in this recovery. When you drill down into business and professional services, you find that one of the big areas of that that's really been growth is employment services, which are temporary workers, which is not necessarily a good thing for the economy, but it is generating a lot of the growth in the business and professional services sector. I mean, some of the jobs in there are like business management and engineering and architectural jobs, et cetera, accountants, et cetera. But the real growth in that sector has been from temporary work, employment services.
UNC Charlotte's Dr. John Connaughton, the Babson Capital Professor of Financial Economics and the Director of the Babson Capital Economic Forecast. We're going to go further in depth in what he sees ahead and what he saw behind us. And we'll talk about going off the cliff as well later on this hour. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Dr. John Connaughton, director of the Babson Capital Economic Forecast, the official forecast for the state of North Carolina, is with us this hour for our quarterly visit on the economy and its recovery. Off the air just a second ago, and I want to hammer on a lame duck, but you said that pretty much the lack of economic recovery in this state is due to because of what Beverly Perdue did or did not do as governor.
I think it's more did not do. I think we just simply lost focus on job growth. We simply have not been focused on that. I'm not sure what we've been focused on, but, you know, this state has always had a very, under previous administrations, a very proactive economic development operation, mm-hmm. Where lots of effort, resources, were put out there to try to attract new industry and businesses into the state and create not just jobs, but good quality jobs.
That puts a lot of pressure, it seems to me, on Governor-elect Pat McCrory. Does he have a plan? Do you think he'll be more proactive?
I hope so. I hope so in both instances. We've got to get back competing. Look, we all hate incentives. We all don't like them because nationally we know it's a zero-sum game. Those firms are going to locate somewhere in the United States. Mm-hmm. But regionally, it is not a zero-sum game. There are winners and there are losers. And the competition, particularly because of this recession, has stepped up considerably in terms of attracting new, good quality jobs. You know, in South Carolina, it's not just that they've created a lot of jobs. They've created a lot of good manufacturing jobs. Those jobs that they've created down the Boeing plant in Charleston in the last year or so have basically raised Charleston's per capita personal income to up to the national level, and it really closed the gap in that metropolitan area as a result of those jobs and some other manufacturing jobs that have come into that area. And remember, this is a community that took an enormously big hit several years ago, a decade or so ago, with the base closures.
Right.
And yet they're back ahead of where they were, both in terms of output, but also in terms of per capita personal income.
And that's because of Nikki Haley?
No, it's not because of Nikki Haley. It's because, I mean, she continued the process and economic development activities that the state has been involved in for a long time. Mm-hmm. She has put emphasis. It's a priority of her administration to generate those jobs. It's one of the top things that they're looking to do. And so when it's something that's near and dear to the heart of the governor, it gets done.
So the unemployment rate, I believe, is 9.3% in North Carolina.
That's correct.
What will it take to reduce that number, and when, if ever, do you see it going down?
Well, you know, next year we're projecting that the economy will be a little bit better than it was this year. That's contingent on several things.
Why are you projecting that it's going to be better?
Well, as you mentioned,
what reason do we have to believe?
As you mentioned in your opening, things have gotten a little better in the last quarter here. A lot of our problems for 2012 were the first two quarters of the year, the first half of the year. Things have gotten a little bit better since then. As you mentioned, housing is starting to bubble up again. We'll actually start to see some folks build some houses, and, you know, that creates jobs, as we all know. Car sales are up nationally, and while we don't have a lot of car we don't have any car manufacturers here. We've got some truck manufacturers, and we've got some suppliers as well. That's going to pick up. The second half of the year has been much, much better than the first half of the year. Not great, but better. And our expectation is if Washington reaches a deal of some kind, that 2013, while not going to be great, will in fact be a little bit better. We're looking at about 1.8% growth for 2013. Again, it's below that number, that 2% that we want to see, and it's not anywhere near the 3.5% that we really want, but it is better. And as a result of that, we'll probably create 50,000-plus jobs next year, so that'll help a little bit.
So with the – how many did we create this year?
30,000.
Okay, 30,000 plus 50 is 80. Where does that take us out of the jobs, deficit of jobs
good
that
we question.
Lost?
We lost 333,000 jobs.
Okay.
Keep that number in mind, 333. It's a little over that, but that's a nice round number. We've gained back about 115,000, roughly a little over a third of them. Okay. So if you gain back, and that includes this year, so if you gain back another 50 next year, almost 60 between now and next year, you're talking about 175,000.
So when these jobs start coming back, and they have started coming back a little bit, are they the same jobs?
No.
Or are they completely different jobs?
They're predominantly different jobs. And even what we lost, of that 333, 200,000 of those jobs were lost in construction and manufacturing.
Mm-hmm.
So the bulk of the job losses in the state were in essentially blue-collar occupations. Where we're adding jobs back, and you already mentioned this, is in business and professional services, health and education services, hospitality, leisure.
Different skill sets.
Yeah, different skill set, different education. And even the modest jobs we're adding back in manufacturing, we're still not adding any construction jobs back, but we are adding a few manufacturing jobs.
But you
jobs
see
back.
Growth in construction next year.
Yeah, we're going to see growth next year.
Right.
But even the jobs we're adding back in manufacturing aren't the same kind of jobs that we lost and require a different skill set, a really different skill set than the jobs that we lost.
So are the people getting these new jobs with different skill sets the same people who lost their jobs, or are these new people? And if these are new people, where are they coming from?
Well, one of the things that we notice is that there are actually shortages of qualified people in the areas where we are creating jobs, which is a very uncomfortable situation to be in, because what happens is in the areas that jobs are being created and we have shortages of qualified workers in those areas, wages start to get bit up. And so you've got a small part of the workforce that is, in fact, receiving great benefit while the economy is growing, but the bulk of it is in stagnant areas of the economy and areas where folks lost their jobs, and there's little prospect, I'm not saying zero, but little prospect that they will have meaningful employment at the level that they had before this all began.
So who are these people that are taking these jobs that require different skills that the older people who lost their jobs don't have?
Well, a lot of them are people that are moving from one job to the next in the normal course of things.
Right.
But most of these are college-educated and typically college-educated with advanced degrees.
Where were they before the recession?
They
still
were all
in school?
Employed. They were all employed probably before the recession. Mm-hmm. And, as they're moving up what we call the job ladder, higher levels of expertise and experience.
But that wouldn't add people. And you're talking about job growth.
That's modest.
Just be moving around.
It's modest growth, but remember, the labor force is expanding for the most part. And so, you've got new people. We've had 5 years of college graduation since this all began.
Okay.
And so that adds a ton of people every year onto the labor market.
Okay.
And we still have net in-migration in this state. I'm not sure why, but we still do have net in-migration.
We have a good reputation.
Yeah, we have a reputation that precedes ourselves, I guess.
We came very close to experiencing a double-dip recession since we started out of the recovery in 2009 from the Great Recession.
And we're not out of that wood yet.
So, okay. I was going to ask you what prevented it, but you're saying that we could have another one.
Well, what prevented it, because a lot of folks in 2012 were talking about a double dip. And we got really, really close. You're right, Mike. In the first half of the year, we got really, really close. But we averted it. The Federal Reserve, again, dumped tons of money. Not much of it got into the economy, but a little bit did get into the economy. And I think we probably overestimated the potential for a double dip in 2012. But 2013 is another risky year. Most economists, most forecasts I see are looking somewhere in the 2% range. But all of those forecasts are based on us not going over the fiscal cliff.
Mm-hmm.
Really, really bad, ugly things happen if we go over that fiscal cliff.
Which we're going to talk about. I don't want to launch into that now because we may not have time in this segment. So we'll talk about it in the third segment of the program so everybody can gird their loins and get ready for disaster here. The Federal Reserve who yesterday said they're going to keep interest rates low until the jobs number reaches a certain goal.
6.5% rate of unemployment, that's right.
So doing that, how is that helping? If nobody's buying stuff, if nobody's taking out loans, how is this low interest rate helping anybody?
There was a song in the 60s, I think, by Skeeter Davis, Wishing and Hoping.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, actually, I think Wishing... And Jackie DeShannon did that, or Dusty Springfield, or somebody.
Somebody like that, yeah. One of those singers. I could have it wrong.
Skeeter Davis may have done it. Who knows?
Yeah. But I think there's a lot of that going on with the Fed with all this quantitative easing, because what we see is they're pumping, and they've been pumping this $40 billion into the economy by buying bonds up of various types, really through most of this recovery.
Mm-hmm.
Month in and month out. They run it for 6 months, take a couple months off, and come up with the next QE, QE 2, 3, 4, whatever, which just stands for quantitative easing.
Mm-hmm.
And it is actually a process by which they're buying bonds. And they're still doing that. The problem is that most of the people that they're – or the institutions they're buying bonds from are banks. And when the banks are giving up their bonds and the Fed gives them cash for that, it winds up in bank vaults. Or, I mean, right now we're sitting with $1.6 trillion of excess reserves, that's in excess of what's required by law,
mm-hmm.
In bank vaults around the country. And the Fed was hoping by doing this that this liquidity, that $1.6 trillion, would wind up being loaned out to businesses,
right,
to stimulate investment and then hopefully stimulate job growth. But it's it's not working. It's what we call pushing on a string. Most of it just winds up in the form of vault cash in banks.
See, maybe I made the leap in the wrong direction, because we've talked about the cash reserve that the banks have in the past. And so I was having a conversation last week with a major player in banking who will go unnamed, because I don't know that he would want me to talk about this. I don't know. But he said, why won't banks lend money? He said, banks are happy to lend. We're ready to lend. We got all this money. Nobody wants it. Nobody wants a loan.
I don't think it's quite that simple, but that's certainly part of it. Okay. Remember, one of the things that's gone on and that's happened here is people have deleveraged. Consumers have. Mm-hmm. Okay. They're not going out. If you go out to the big box stores this Christmas, you're not seeing people buying something 90 to 180 days, same as cash, that kind of stuff. They're buying what they can afford to buy out of their pockets. As a result of that, companies like Best Buy, companies like H.H. Gregg or whatever, they are not needing to borrow money from the banks to finance these purchases. And so that's really what's going on. More and more folks that are buying cars are buying used cars and not financing them, etc. And you push this through the whole economy, and so there is some of that going on.
Why wouldn't you take advantage of 90 days same as cash? That is cash. That is buying what you can afford.
People, yeah, I understand that. But most folks right now, and this is the new normal, Mike, most folks are very comfortable buying what they can afford to buy right out of their pocketbooks today.
Well, in the good times when we have these conversations, that's precisely what we wanted people to do, because we were so over-leveraged and had so much bad credit out there, and now we're complaining that we've done it.
Yes.
And you're smiling about it.
Well, I was not one complaining about over-leveraging by consumers. I think those were individual cases. But generally speaking, consumers drive this economy. They're 70% of GDP. And if consumers aren't out there spending and borrowing to spend, buying new cars, big TVs, new appliances, the economy suffers.
Are there other healthy economies elsewhere in the world or elsewhere in history that were not driven by consumer spending, to the extent that ours seems to be?
Interestingly enough, Germany probably is the only one that's not driven by consumer spending.
What's it driven by?
It's driven by exports. Yeah, remember, we talk about China as being, but Germany is actually, from a dollar value, the largest exporter in the world.
But in truth, everything is driven by consumer spending, because there would be no exports in Germany if somebody didn't buy them.
If other folks didn't buy them, that's right. Okay, but in Germany, their economy is not driven by domestic consumption.
Well, should we fix that? Should we structure our economy, and can you deliberately structure an economy not to be built on something as flighty as consumer will or whims?
Well, I don't think it's normally that flighty. I mean, obviously it's up and down, but so are exports up and down. I mean, Germany is not doing all that well. They're not doing as bad as the rest of Europe right now, but they're not doing all that well because their exports to other countries are down, not just the U.S.
That's because of the problems in the Eurozone?
The Eurozone, yeah. I mean, right now what we're looking at, and this is the other thing that's really, really scary about next year that's independent of the fiscal cliff, Eurozone is in recession. Okay, if you want a poster child and see a movie about what fiscal austerity does to your economy, all you got to do is turn around and look at Europe. And you've got countries in Europe, not just one, but several, with 25% plus unemployment rates. Most of the countries in the Eurozone are in double-digit unemployment right now. They are officially in recession. The most optimistic forecast for Eurozone growth next year, 2013, is in the tenths of percent range, 2/10, 3/10 of percent, depending on which forecast you look at. And I think those are optimistic. It may be that they're in recession again next year. Just picked up that Japan announced the other day that they are now officially, in terms of the way they define it, in recession as well. So now you've got two of the top economies in the world, the Eurozone economy and the Japanese economy, in recession. China is not in recession. They're the second largest economy in the world, but they are in a little bit of trouble in that, they're not growing at 9% anymore. They're growing at 6 or 7%, and for them, that's catastrophic.
Good news abounds. John Connaughton, our guest today on Charlotte Talks here on WFAE. You say in your economic forecast the labor force participation rate is declining. I've never heard that term before. So what do you mean by labor force participation rate?
First of all, to me, this is the scariest thing that we've observed in this cycle. Okay. Secondly, this is a very difficult concept to do without visual aids. Okay? So it's not really a radio
I'll draw on the microphone.
All right. You can hear me. But if people can think, the labor force participation rate is the percent, okay, of folks 16 years of age or older who are not institutionalized. That's just a technical term. But it's basically everybody of working age.
Right.
It's the percent of those that either have a job or are actively looking for a job, essentially what we classify as employed and unemployed people. Historically, that number, the percent of the population that was engaged in the labor force, has been north of 66%. Even during recessions, it has never, on a monthly basis, but back all the way to World War II, has never dropped below about 65.5% in the depths of any recession. Now it is down 63.6%. We've basically knocked off 2 percentage points on the labor force participation rate. It's about 6 million people that have basically dropped out of the labor force.
Just given up.
They've just given up. I don't know any other way to describe it. I some folks are trying to say, well, you know, it's the baby boomers are starting to get retirement age. Mike, that's not really the case. I mean, yeah, some of them are, but only the people that were born in 46, 47, 48, which is the leading edge of the baby boomers. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the baby boomer, if you look at them, the numbers of people looks like a bell curve. At the very leading edge, there's a few. But the bulk of the baby boomers, of the 77 million that we're talking about that are classified as baby boomers, were born in the 50s. They're not there yet. They're still in their late 50s, okay? So it's not as a result of aging out and retiring. This is really 6 million people that are discouraged workers. And the scariest thing about this is that if you were to – right now we're looking at just under 8% rate of unemployment. If you were to add those 6 million people back in, and, of course, you'd add them back in as unemployed people, you'd have an unemployment rate north of 11%.
Wow.
Yeah. So all we have to do is say, okay, let's make the labor force participation rate 66% like it probably should be, and the numbers would turn out to be over 11% rate of unemployment. So the true rate of unemployment is pretty bad compared to what the published rate is.
Wow. When we come back, Dr. John Connaughton will take us over the fiscal cliff, or at least metaphorically speaking, we'll do it. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Dr. John Connaughton, our guest, a quarterly visitor, his looming dark presence.
Maybe not after today, right?
He's the director of the Babson Capital Economic Forecast from UNC Charlotte, the state's official forecast. So we talked about how we are facing a risk to the economy in the coming year because of recession in the Eurozone and recession in Japan. And then we have flirted talking about it, and we're going to talk about it now. The fiscal cliff, the so-called fiscal cliff. And for anybody who may not completely understand what that is, explain it.
Well, what happened a year and a half ago in the summer of 2011 was that we had reached our debt ceiling limit, okay, which basically meant that Congress authorizes the upper limit of money that the Treasury can borrow. When you run deficits, you have to borrow money. When you run $1 trillion a year deficits, you got to borrow $1 trillion every year. You don't get to retire any of the money you borrowed before. What happened was that the debt ceiling was raised. It's now $16.4 trillion. But in doing that, the agreement was essentially to kick the can down the road and not deal actually with the deficit. And Republicans wanted to deal with the deficit. Democrats wanted to deal with tax rates because what you've got is a situation where Republicans are making the argument that the problem, the reason that we have $1 trillion-plus deficit for the past 4 years is because of size of government and out-of-control spending, and particularly as it relates to entitlements. The Democrats, on the other hand, are saying, no, 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 the problem is the Bush-era tax cuts, which means that everybody's tax rates were lower, and so we don't collect as much revenue, and so it's a revenue problem.
What about the two wars?
Yeah, there's also that.
How come that never comes up?
Well, actually, there are a series of things that never come up. This is kind of like, I'm reminded of this movie back in the 80s. Remember A Few Good Men? And at the end of the movie, the Lieutenant Caffey is interrogating Colonel Jessup, and he demands, he says, I want the truth. And Colonel Jessup says, you can't handle the truth.
Right.
Well, this is a lot of what's going on now. I mean, yes, entitlements are a little out of control. Yes, maybe tax rates could be a little higher. But, you know, if you do both of those things, you still run in trillion-dollar deficits. The problem, Mike, is what we talked about in the first segment, and that is we don't have any economic growth.
Right.
We've got those 6 million people that have left the labor force. When you leave the labor force and you don't have a job, you don't pay taxes.
And is that because the growth that we experienced prior to the recession was a house of cards?
No. Actually, no. That's not really the case, as it turns out. It had a card component to it in terms of the effect on housing, but that was probably less than a percent of the GDP growth that we're experiencing. So we would have had higher GDP growth than we have now. But back to the fiscal cliff. So by kicking the can down the road, what they did was not deal with these issues. What happens is that by law, two things are going to happen on January 1st. One, all of the Bush-era tax cuts, all the tax cuts, which affect everybody, are going to expire.
So your tax rates will go up, meaning your taxes will likely go up if you have a job.
That's right.
Your the money you pay on capital gains will increase precipitously.
I'll give you the rates in just a second.
Okay.
So that's one thing that happens. All right. Second thing that happens is, as part of the bargain that was reached last year, is that we have this thing called sequestration,
right,
which is some automatic spending cuts, half of which have to come out of the military, the other half have to come out of other discretionary programs. Mm-hmm. Bottom line is this. On January 1st, if nothing happens between now and then, we will have, one, a $95 billion increase in Social Security taxes because the 2% Social Security tax holiday that we've all enjoyed for the last 2 years will go away, and there's no one's interested in keeping that.
And to the average person, that means what? How much money?
Could be as much as $2,000 take-home pay a year.
Okay.
That's right. So that's number one. That's $95 billion. Number two, the Bush-era tax cuts go away. That's about $110 billion.
Which means what to the average person?
Depending on where you live, somewhere between $2,000 and $5,000 out of annual household.
So now we're talking about $4,000 to $7,000 in additional taxes.
And it gets better.
Okay.
All right. Number three, we have the sequestration, which means the federal government will spend roughly $110 billion less. Mm-hmm. And half of that's in defense industries. We know we've already heard about potential layoffs in the defense industry, so those are people who aren't going to pay taxes. It gets even better, Mike. The actually biggest piece is something that no one is talking about, and that is the what's called the AMT patch, which is the alternative minimum tax. This was designed back in the 60s so that people with lots of deductions and higher incomes would pay a minimum average tax rate. It was never indexed to inflation, but all along Congress has indexed it. That indexation is expiring.
So a lot of people will be caught up in that.
A lot of people will be caught up on that. I would suspect that a good more than half of the listening audience will get caught up. But here's the best. No, it's scarier than that, Mike. That doesn't expire on January 1st, 2013. If Congress doesn't act, the expiration is actually January 1st, 2012. So people will be subject to the AMT this year potentially if nothing happens. When they file in April, that's $125 billion. You take them all together, add them all up, and at the end of the day, you get $440 billion. I know that's a lot of numbers for radio, but $440 billion is about 2.9% of GDP pulled out of consumer spending and government spending. You do the math. If you're only going to grow at 2%, you can see what that's going to mean to the economy next year.
So that is why you say if that happens, the mild recovery that you see for next year would become a recession.
Absolutely. And I think there are no outliers in this. That's a consensus.
So why do they seem so easygoing about this? And why aren't they in constant 24-hour-day meetings in Washington?
Ben Bernanke, the Federal Reserve Chair, told them 3 months ago that if they did not act, then his forecast would be about a 9.5% unemployment rate by fall of 2013.
So why aren't they acting? Why aren't they doing something? Why aren't they in meetings?
Now let's back off.
Is that because the problem is too darn difficult to solve?
No, it's not too difficult to solve. It requires Republicans giving and Democrats giving. That's what it requires.
The question.
Yeah. It requires what we do every day in our lives with the relationships we have with family, friends, business people. It's called compromise.
And
we have to have that compromise. I will say this. Mm-hmm. I am fairly confident. Mm-hmm. More than 50% confident that a deal will get done before January 1st.
Because we're facing $1.2 trillion in automatic spending cuts and additional tax increases on January 1st if Congress and the president don't reach an agreement. And North Carolina Senator, go ahead and stop.
That's part of the problem is those numbers are bandying about. Actually, that's not the case.
Okay.
That's a 10-year forecast.
Okay.
Okay? That's All right. So, I mean, it's not that big a number.
Okay.
It's in the $100 billion range for just the Bush tax cuts.
Okay, well, based on those
just
numbers,
on 2013.
Based on those numbers,
yeah.
North Carolina Senator Kay Hagan has warned that the automatic defense budget cuts could mean the loss of 34,000 defense jobs in North Carolina alone. She says it would also mean a $2,200 tax hike for a family of four and the loss of $83 million in biomedical research money here and 1,600 jobs that that money supports. You have to multiply that, I suppose, by 50 for the 50 states. That would mean national economic big-time problems.
It's a recession, and Bernanke said it will be a 9.5% rate of unemployment by the end of the year or by the fall of 2013. Yeah. I don't think we're going to go over the fiscal cliff, Mike. I think that it's cooler. I think what they're doing right now, I'm no political scientist, but what I suspect is if they give in too early, they'll look like they gave something away.
Yeah.
And so they've got to go right up to the cliff. It's a repeat. I mean, you could have this a week and a half before the deadline in the summer of 2011. It looked like the world was coming in and we're going to default on all of our notes.
Unless you're a complete dolt, it appears relatively easy to understand that we need both tax revenue increases, whether you call them tax increases or revenue increases, is immaterial. We need more money coming in, and we need less money going out. And you call that a deadly combination to the economy.
Well, now, let's back off a second. The worst case is $440 billion. That really hurts. Let's suppose they get together and they fix the AMT patch, okay? Mm-hmm. We do something on the top 2%, whether it's rate increases or limit itemized deductions or some combination of the two. And so we have some compromise there. I don't see us anybody giving in and continuing on the 2% payroll tax holiday, although I think discretion would be take a percent away and give us a 1% holiday in that. And there will be some spending cuts, okay? Our guess is that we'll probably get somewhere between $200 and $250 billion of tax increases and spending cuts if their compromise is reached before January 1st, and that's what our 1.8% forecast is based on.
And how will that impact the deficit? Will it make a dent?
It'll take a $1.3 trillion deficit down to about $1.05 trillion. Yeah, the real problem here is there's
does that remain unsustainable? Because it appears it's unsustainable.
Yes, I hate the word unsustainable, but yes, you're right. It is unsustainable long term. The problem here is this, Mike. There are two issues that we have to deal with. One issue is that we have had a borrow and spend program for the last 5 years in this country. And at a certain point in time, you have to pay the piper for it.
Right.
We cannot continue on. Debt is over 100% of GDP. Right now we can afford it because we're paying ridiculously low interest rates when we borrow money. But if we were to be paying 5 or 6% rates of interest, the debt service would swamp our budget. So we've got to deal with this problem. You can't deal with it just with taxes and spending. If you do, you're going to get the European result. The Europeans aren't stupid, okay? Mm-hmm. They're reasonably intelligent folks. They have reasonably good economists and politicians over there, and they decided to bite the bullet and deal with their out of control spending, and it's put them into recession, and they're willing to accept that for several years in order to put their fiscal house in order. I don't think politically we have the will to do that right now, but at some point in time we're going to have to chip away. There is another option, though, Mike. There is another option that wasn't available to Europe. And that is that we could stimulate the economy and grow our way out of this thing without inflation. If we can get back to a 3.5% rate of growth by incentivizing risk-taking on the part of businesses, consumers, banks, et cetera, we could possibly, with 3.5% rate of growth, get away from this trillion-dollar debt deficit problem in 3 or 4 years.
So how do you do that?
You've got, as I said, you've got to incentivize risk. And right now, that's if I were to tell you that we would have to incentivize risk-taking by banks, you can imagine how rapidly I'd be booed out of the room.
And by incentivize, you mean what?
You give them tax breaks for loans.
But we need money. We need the revenue. Giving them a tax break decreases our revenue.
Well,
we're in a rock on a hard place here, aren't
but,
we?
But if by doing that, if by deregulating banks a little bit and incentivizing them to make loans, okay? Mm-hmm. And they can push those out and create private sector investment that creates jobs. It will in fact produce more revenue than what you're giving up to incentivize the system.
But debt isn't necessarily a bad thing. This amount of increasing debt is unsustainable. But if we get a handle on that, it's not a bad thing to have a national debt, is it?
No, but again, I refer to it always as the German rule, because they try to institute this on Greece, and that's the 3% German rule. A deficit that's 3% of GDP is probably not a problem. Right now, we're at 8.6% of GDP, so we're definitely not in a conservative position in terms of that. So if we were to be running a $500 billion deficit or $400 billion deficit right now, this would not be a problem. But trillion plus is difficult.
Dr. John Connaughton is director of the Babson Capital Economic Forecast at UNC Charlotte, our guest every quarter here on Charlotte Talks here on WFAE. Well, a resolution to this, knowing what the tax structure is going to be, what the rates will be, what the alternative minimum tax is going to be, what the tax on dividends and investment income is going to be, and knowing what deductions like the homeowner mortgage interest deduction is going to be, whether it's going to exist or not. Will that remove uncertainty and therefore stimulate people to take action and start borrowing money and start growing?
Absolutely. I mean, what's scarier than risk is uncertainty. You just don't know what's going to happen. And you've given a list of things that have been sitting out there for the last 6 to 9 months that have been kind of holding back potentially the economy. The number one thing you've got to do is, okay, let's suppose that Boehner decides, oh, I'm going to give in to Obama, and I'm going to let the top two rates rise. So the top rates go from 31% to 35%, and the top rate, next top rate goes from 31 to 35, and the top rate goes from 35 to 39.6. Okay. And he gives in. He can only do that if the rest of the tax cuts to everybody else, the Bush rates, are defined as being permanent. We've had this temporary tax cut for the last 10 years.
Yeah.
And it comes up for renewal, and we'll kick the can down the road for another 18 months. Whatever they decide, and I, from an economic standpoint, I don't think the rates are as critical as permanency in the rates. So that you don't run into a situation where 6 months from now, 18 months from now, the rates or the tax codes could change. And that's the case with itemized deductions. It's the case with dividend income, capital gains income, et cetera. Let's set the rates. Mm-hmm. Let's make them permanent. And let's live with those rates.
This kind of uncertainty is certainly impacting people like you who follow the economy very closely. It certainly probably impacts big business who have economists on staff or on call to help them make decisions about what to do in the future. But is this kind of uncertainty impacting the average person? Are people not buying a car this month because they don't know what's going to happen on January 1st? Are they not buying a house this month because they don't know what's happening on January the 1st?
Yeah, I think that's probably the case. Now, I don't think it extends so much to cars as it does to houses. I think that's really a big area because this uncertainty as to mortgage deductibility, this has been talked about for several years now. It's gotten a lot more steam.
If that goes away, and I only have 20 seconds. If that goes away, the mortgage deduction, what will that do to housing and the people buy it?
Short term, it will hurt housing. There's no question about it. Longer term, if it comes coupled with rate decreases from the Bush level rates, it may not be as bad a situation.
Dr. John Connaughton, who sees a slightly better year ahead next year than this in the absence of the fiscal cliff. He's the director of the Babson Capital Economic Forecast at UNC Charlotte. Thanks for the hour.